I stopped to greet her and I was smiling as it had crossed my mind to ask her to go for a bus ride into the country and I would try as hard as I could to give her a happy and carefree day. She stopped in front of me and before I could get out a word of greeting she slapped me across the face as hard as she could, at the same time shouting that I was living with a woman old enough to be my mother. Having delivered this bombshell she turned on her heels and marched out of my life forever. As I stood in the middle of the pavement red with embarrassment, my face stinging from Gladys Wallop, I was horribly conscious of the amused, scornful or sympathetic stares from the crowds who had probably not been so entertained on a Saturday shopping trip for many a long day. Suddenly I knew, with a blinding conviction, that from now on I would give up any thought of a career as a dancer. I knew there was something far more important I had to do with my life. I would give all my life, all my gifts and all my devotion to serving my fellow man and to proving through my mediumship the glorious, comforting truth of man's survival of his bodily death. 6-1 night when our circle was meeting on the usual evening, something happened which convinced me beyond all doubt that I had made the right decision. The six of us were sitting together in the quiet darkness, when a man's voice began to speak to us in a foreign language. We listened to him without understanding a word. Finally Edith ventured tentatively, "I am not certain but I think it might be Italian." "Si, signora," said the spirit voice, "Italian was my mother tongue when I was on earth but I knew some English too and I will speak so that you may all understand. My name was Valentino and I have come tonight to say how happy I am that this young man has at last accepted the life path he must tread. I want to tell him that one day when he is a famous medium he will hold a seance in the room which was my bedroom in my house in Hollywood, and I will come to speak to him there when he does so. At last, after all the messages from the various mediums and all the letters from Munich, Valentino had spoken to me in his own voice through my own developed mediumship. Even if the idea of my ever reaching Hollywood seemed preposterous at the time, his message filled me with joy and the desire to use my gift to help people. From that night onwards Edith began with great tact and gentleness to educate me for the public work she knew I must do. She would ask me to read to her, then she would correct my grammar and pronunciation. She taught me table manners and many of the small courtesies and refinements which would make it easier for me to feel conidiarus's negation dent when I had to be in the public eye and meet people of all kinds. Many times I must have jarred on her unbearably because of my ignorance and the uncouthness of my manners, but she never let me know it and slowly, and with an idiarus's negation night kindness, she changed me from the country lad I was into a man acceptable on most levels of society. She opened out for me a new world of books, music and art, she made life a richer and fuller experience than it could ever have been without her. I owed her so much more than I could ever repay. Some months after Valentino had spoken at our circle Edith greeted me one evening when I came home from work with some extraordinary news. The medium of a small local spiritualist church had eloped with a member of his congregation, so the church committee had invited me to take his place on the platform at the next service. I wondered if I was ready to speak and demonstrate in public. The very idea frightened me to death. But Edith said I must have complete trust in the spiritual beings who use me as a channel in our circle, so I agreed to take the place of the missing medium. On the day of the service, which was to be my first public work as a medium, Edith and I went along to the church an hour early with the idea of arranging flowers in vases for the platform. As we arrived outside the church with our arms full of flowers and leaves we were startled to see two men loading chairs into a van outside the entrance. In the church we learned, from a rather distracted member of the committee, that the chairs were being repossessed by the company who had supplied them, because the higher purchase payments were so heavily in arrears. The thought of a service where not only the congregation but those on the platform, including the medium, had to stand throughout because there was nothing to sit on was hardly encouraging. A diligent search of our resources by Edith and me yielded 30-odd shillings between us and we went to offer this to the men hoping they would leave the chairs for one more night. The men sympathized with our dilemma, but they told us they must have the full amount owing or take the chairs. I stood on the pavement disconsolately watching the last of the chairs disappear into the jaws of their removals vehicle when a big friendly hand clapped me on the shoulder. "Nay, lad, no need to be down in Tmouth. You will not let them take the chairs from under you." I turned to see Mr. Whittaker, a plain-spoken and kindly Yorkshireman who had sat in Mrs. Cook's circle with his wife. "Ah, Alice knew ye had it in ye, lad, and I'll give ye t'chance to show it." Mr. Whittaker, bless him, pulled out his checkbook and soon the chairs were being carted back into the church. As soon as I stepped to the edge of the platform that night to speak, I felt the familiar sensation of the room rushing away from me and I lost consciousness of my surroundings. When I woke from the trance an hour later, I learned that I had delivered a most interesting discourse, followed by a brilliant demonstration of clairvoyance, all under the control of a spirit who introduced himself as White Wing, one of the spiritually evolved entities who often controlled me in our circle before my independent direct voice mediumship developed. Since it was not possible for the voices to manifest in a fully lighted hall, White Wing had clearly come to help me out in this first public appearance by taking control of me in trance. After the meeting had closed, members of the congregation crowded around me to tell me about the wonderful proofs they had been given, that the dead lived on in another plane of being and had not ceased to care for those they had left behind them. As I saw the happiness which shone from the faces of those who told me their stories of the way in which husband, father, son or mother had proved their continuing existence, I felt humble and deeply grateful to have been used to bring such joy. That night Edith and I sat up late talking over the events at the meeting and we both agreed that if my trance mediumship could bring such comfort to the bereaved, how much more convincing proof could be given if people were able to talk to their loved ones and hear them reply through my independent direct voice mediumship. We both knew that to offer this comfort to the people we must open a mission of our own, where we could provide the darkened room which the average spiritualist church does not require, since trance mediumship or clairvoyance, which is normally presented in spiritualist churches, can be given in full light. It is only physical mediumship, materialization, apportation or the direct voice which needs to be conducted in complete darkness. We talked long and late about this possibility and realized we would need at least some capital and I would have to give up my job. Before we went to bed we decided to save every penny, in the hope that one day we would have enough to open a church of our own. After the successful meeting at the local church, I began to receive invites to take meetings at other churches outside the area in which I lived. As I gradually became known, my services were in demand throughout Hertfordshire. But always I cherished the dream of our own mission and we saved to make it a reality. One Sunday afternoon Edith and I were relaxing in front of the Idiaresis Negationary after what I had learned to call luncheon, when I saw Edith, who was looking out of the window, turn white and bite her lip as if something had vexed her. When I asked her what was wrong, she told me that her parents were outside with the obvious intention of ringing our doorbell. Edith was fond of her parents, but she had long since grown away from the rigid orthodoxy of their religious beliefs and she very much resented their intolerance of spiritualism, the truth of which she had been convinced of long before I met her. In common with most psychics, I am rarely granted any premonition of personal disaster, and that Sunday was no exception. Once Edith had ushered her parents into the sitting room, I rose to greet them with the ingenuous friendliness of a dog wagging its tail. Beaming a big welcome at them both, I held out my hand to her father. To my astonishment, he struck it away from him as though it were some species of poisonous serpent. Then he embarked on a tirade against spiritualism, and mediums in particular, the imaginative verbal abuse of which I have never heard equaled since. First, he castigated me for what he called dabbling and delving into the devil's own mysteries, then he described vividly the somewhat specialized torments which awaited me in hell for allowing myself to be used by evil and impersonating spirits, whose only aim was to seduce souls from the light. I listened to him open-mouthed. I had never before heard this point of view about the gentle philosophy in which I believe. I could hardly believe my own ears. Edith tried to stem her father's idiocy's negation out of denunciation, but then he turned on her and, to the astonishment of both of us, accused her, with many an Old Testament epithet, of living with me in sin and lechery. When I attempted to intervene, to point out both the injustice and the inaccuracy of this attack, it merely inspired him with a new fusillade of abuse. When the patriarch had exhausted both his thunder and himself, he gathered up his more introvert lady wife and swept her out of our wicked abode where defilement dwelt. When they had gone, I dried Edith's tears and tried to comfort her. As I did so, it was suddenly and blindingly obvious to me that I truly loved this kind and gentle lady who was my friend, my teacher, my confidant and the center of my life. Then and there I begged her to marry me. She refused even to think of it because of the difference in our ages, and the more I pleaded with her the more adamant she became, and, on that occasion at least, I gave up trying to persuade her. At long last the day came when we thought we had saved up enough to start our own mission. I gave my notice at John Maxwell's shop, and while I was working my final 2 weeks I found a large unfurnished room over a shop in nearby Watford, which I rented for a very few shillings a week, though my courage almost failed me at the thought of taking on even so small a commitment when I would soon be without a job. Edith and I spent our free time painting, staining and polishing the bare floorboards and making curtains, and when we had installed a couple of dozen chairs, bought on hire purchase, our somewhat dreary room in that Watford side street had been transformed into a pleasant and comfortable church. Finally, an advertisement in the local paper announced that Watford Spiritualist Mission had opened its doors. However long I may live, nothing can ever equal the thrill of my first service in my own church. Every seat was filled and latecomers were crowded at the back of the room. I was taken into trance for the address and the clairvoyance, and after I had returned to the waking state, the feeling of joy and lightness I sensed in that crowded room was indescribable. I knew then that all the weeks of hard work, penny pinching and anxiety were all worthwhile. We went on as we had started, and very soon we had to buy more chairs, while we were still paying off the installments on the first lot. Needless to say, in spite of the number of people who came to the mission, many were as hard up as I was myself, so there was barely enough in the collections taken at each service to pay the rent, light, heating and the installments on 2 lots of chairs. For my own living expenses I relied on private direct voice seances, which I held once a week in the sitting room of Edith's council house, and for which I charged 1 guinea for 2 persons. I wanted those who could not attend private seances, either because they could not afford them or because they were busy working when they were held, to have this experience. Of all the different forms of mediumship, I think direct voice gives the most convincing proof of survival after bodily death. So Edith and I decided to hold an open circle after our usual Thursday evening service. When the service was over and the congregation had gone home, a few people who had booked a seat for 2 shillings would remain behind, and we would sit in darkness and people whom the world calls dead would come and talk to us. My voice mediumship by this time was almost fully developed, and I was most often fully conscious during these group seances, so I could listen to all that was said, both by the members of the circle and their spirit friends and relations from the other side. Sometimes the talks between them were so intimate and so charged with emotion I often felt like an eavesdropper. On one occasion a man's voice said he wanted to speak to his son George, and he was answered by a man sitting in the circle. The discarnate father proceeded to take the living son to task for his extravagance and begged him to cut down his drinking and to be kinder and more considerate to someone named Anne. When the circle was closed and people were leaving for home, a lady and gentleman lingered behind to talk to me. The man introduced himself, and I learned that he was a famous Idiocesis Negation LM director. He told me he was completely convinced he had been speaking to his dead father, not only because no one else in the world had ever called him George, which was not his baptismal name, but because the content of the little lecture and the mannerisms of speech were typical of his father in life. Then he brought forward the lady who was with him and introduced her to me as his wife, Anne. On another of these Thursday open circle meetings, after various friends and relatives had spoken in the usual way, we heard a woman's voice trying to speak to us, in the uncertain way in which new communicators sometimes manifest. Eventually her voice became stronger, although she sounded distressed. She told us she was Lucy Doris Govell, who had lived on St. Albans Road, Watford, and she was a secretary who had been murdered, but her body had not yet been found. Her voice faded, and one of the souls who guide me from the other side came through to tell us that the girl was distressed at the manner of her passing. She was also very worried about the man who had killed her. He was her lover and apparently less to blame for what had happened than she was herself. Naturally, we watched the local newspapers after this sitting to see if the facts the girl had given us about herself would be verified. After only a few days, we read that the girl's body had been discovered and the man she had been living with had disappeared. At our next open circle, the murdered girl returned to speak to us once more, and though she was calmer, she was still concerned about her lover who had not yet been found by the police. She told us that on the night of her death her lover had been out on his own, and when he came home in the early hours he wakened her and they had a furious row. She had said angry and bitter things which goaded him beyond endurance, and he hit out at her with the bicycle pump he had in his hand. He had not meant to do her any serious injury, but because of a physical abnormality of her own the blow had killed her. The lover was terrified that no one would believe his story, so foolishly he ran away. The girl said the police would find him sitting in a local park playing with a piece of string, trying to find the courage to take his own life. A day or so later we read in the local paper that the man had been found and arrested in just the way the girl had described. He was sent for trial on a charge of murder, and during this period the girl returned to speak to us several times. Each time she came, she told us with great confidence that her lover would not be found guilty of her murder, and that the charge would be reduced to manslaughter. She said he would be sentenced to 5 years in prison, and in the end this is exactly what happened. One night, at another of our open circles, a woman from the other side of life spoke to a man sitting in the group. She said that she was his first wife, who had been burned to death in Uidaresis Negationry at their factory. She told him how happy she was that he had married her younger sister, and glad that they had so much enjoyed their honeymoon in Brazil. This man stayed behind after the séance was over to tell me how impressed he was with my demonstration of mediumship, and to ask if he could speak to me privately on a matter of great importance. I agreed to accompany him to a nearby café where we could talk privately over a cup of coffee. In the café I learned my new friend was Mr. Noah Zerdin, one of the founders and the head of the Link Association of Home Circles. The object of this organization was to bring together as many members of spiritualist home circles throughout the world as possible, to exchange experiences they had in their circles, and to provide a common meeting ground for people of like interests. I was most interested to learn about Mr. Zerdin's work with the Link, but I sat up in my cafe chair with a jerk when he asked me if I realized that I was risking my life every time I held one of my open circles for direct voice. I suppose I must have looked as shocked as I felt, for Mr. Zerdin went on to say how dangerous it was for me to allow any old Tom, Dick or Harry to attend these seances. He explained that at such times there exuded from me a life force called ectoplasm, by means of which the voices of the spirit people could manifest, and if any person in the circle, through malice or mere curiosity, shone the bright light on me, this life force would rush back into my body with such violence that it would cause me either a violent shock or, worse still, internal hemorrhage and death. I gaped at him. I simply could not imagine that people who were being helped and comforted by my mediumship would want to harm me. There would always be those who doubted the genuineness of the phenomena, Mr. Zerdin explained, and they would consider they were acting in the interests of others if they tried to expose some medium whose powers were attracting a following. I protested that surely common sense must tell such people that it was impossible for me to know the intimate details of other people's lives of which the voices spoke. Nor could I, by any stretch of the imagination, speak in the hundreds of voices and accents, both male and female, which were heard at my seances. Mr. Zerdin persisted in warning me that many people were deeply prejudiced against the phenomena of spiritualism, either because of religious bigotry or because of intellectual convictions of a nihilist nature. He said such people would welcome the chance to create a disturbance at seances like mine and would think nothing of the possible harm it might cause the medium, even if they knew enough about the subject to know the damage they might inflict. Mr. Zerdin went on to say mediumship such as mine was so rare that I must preserve it, treasure it and protect it, so that as many people as possible might be blessed by it. He suggested that I should sit regularly for a while in his own home circle, each member of which was highly experienced in psychic science, and during these sittings the circle as a whole would concentrate exclusively on the greater development of my mediumship. Then when the time was ripe they would consider how best to bring me out of obscurity to serve in a wider and more public eye diocese negation elsewhere. Instead of convincing a mere handful of people in my little mission, I could spread the truth of man's survival of death to thousands. Going home on the bus that night I thought carefully over everything Mr. Zerdin had said. He was a most impressive man and I had been deeply moved by his burning sincerity and the compassion which urged him to share his conviction with as many people as possible. Apparently he had been an atheist for many years before his own conviction of survival had changed his life for the better, and now he was filled with the desire to help humanity, just as he had been helped. By the time I got home I had made up my mind, not only to take his advice to be more careful about the intentions of those who I invited to my seances, but also to accept his offer of sitting in his circle for the greater development of my powers. For many months after that night I sat regularly in Noah Zerdin's circle, which was held in a pleasant house in Merton Park where he lived with his delightful wife Goldie. Because of the unselfish and devoted way in which the Zerdin circle concentrated their thoughts and prayers on me, the voices greatly increased in strength. I still carried on with my work at the mission during these months, although I cut down on my open circles, owing to a new commitment with Noah's Link organization to hold small groups for members, in conditions where my mediumship could operate properly. I also continued to hold my weekly seance in Edith's house while she was at work and while Owen was at school, in order to earn the guinea which was my livelihood. One afternoon I was standing at the window of Edith's sitting room looking out for a Miss M. Tucker who had booked an appointment by letter. Suddenly my eyes almost popped out of my head like two organ stops, as an immaculate Rolls Royce pulled up outside a house and a smart chauffeur helped out a large lady whom I presumed must be Miss Tucker. Cars like this were hardly a common sight on a council estate, and the lady's progress to our front door was followed with passionate interest by various neighbors, who were standing on their doorsteps or peering from behind curtains. I opened the door when the bell rang and learned that the lady was indeed Miss Tucker, and she turned out to be a very nice person, with none of the disdainful airs and graces I had feared the owner of such a splendid car might possess. I ushered her into the sitting room and when she was comfortably seated I turned off the light and the seance began. After a few minutes the boyish cockney voice of Mickey, the spirit helper who acts as a sort of master of ceremonies at my seances, greeted the lady and told her he was going to help her mother and sister speak to her. He was as good as his word and shortly Miss Tucker was having an affectionate and intimate chat with her deceased mother and sister. When these two spirits had said their goodbyes a man's voice was heard announcing himself as Edison and demanding to know why the lady had not brought Louis with her. They had a short conversation and Miss Tucker promised to bring Louis with her next week, if the medium would give her another appointment. Naturally I was glad to do this. The following week at the appointed hour the big Rolls Royce once again stopped outside a house. This time Miss Tucker got out of the car with an elderly man. He was short, red-faced and rather jolly-looking and he wore a monocle. I opened the door and Miss Tucker introduced the man as Mr. Louis and we went into the sitting room for the seance. Miss Tucker's mother communicated with her for a short while, then Mickey told her her other loved ones would stand aside on this occasion because Mr. Edison was very anxious to speak to Louis. Shortly the same man's voice we had heard the previous week spoke, "Hello. Louis. It's Thomas speaking." "Thomas?" said the little man, Thomas who? Don't you know me, Louis? It's Thomas Alva Edison speaking, said the voice. Don't you remember when we were together in the States? Surely you haven't forgotten how we worked together, struggled together to invent things? Now the little man gladly greeted the spirit who called himself Thomas Alva Edison, and a fascinating conversation ensued between them which I could not help but overhear. They talked about times they had enjoyed together in the past and people they had both known. I heard them refer more than once to Houdini, the famous escapologist who once allowed himself to be tied and chained inside a barrel which was sent over Niagara Falls, and he lived to tell the tale. They talked about the magician's mask line and Divant who, according to the discarnate Edison, had a regular show in St. George's Hall at the turn of the century. I listened enthralled to their talk, although most of the people they mentioned were unknown to me, and I only found out later who they had been and what they had done. When the seance was over and the light was turned on again, Miss Tucker confessed that the man she had introduced as Mr. Louis was really her husband, Dr. Louis Young, who had been very friendly with Thomas Edison in the States during the 1880s and 1890s. She told me that Tucker was her maiden name, which she still used for her business in London, the Tucker Manufacturing Company in Harlesden, but she had deliberately misled me about their names so that if any evidence came through it would be more valuable. Dr. Young told me he had sat with many mediums over the years, both in this country and in America, but the evidence he had received that day was incontrovertibly the best he had ever received. Because he had devised many tricks and illusions for Maskline and Divant in the old days, it had made him very aware of the possibility of fraud, but after talking with his old friend and sharing with him their joint memories, he was convinced that he had been speaking to Thomas Alva Edison himself. I saw a great deal of Miss Tucker and her husband. They sat with me on many occasions and we became great friends. Many famous people came to talk to Dr. Young, who seemed to have known many of the great men of science and letters. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Oliver Lodge and many others of the same eminence came regularly to talk with him. After many months of sitting in the Zurdin Circle, Noah and the Committee of the Link decided to organize a big London meeting at which I would demonstrate my now greatly strengthened voice mediumship. The meeting was advertised for several weeks in advance in the spiritualist newspaper Psychic News, and it was to take place after the 5th annual conference of the Link Association in Bloomsbury's Victoria Hall on Saturday, May 16, 1936. Big direct voice seance, medium Leslie Flint, said the advertisement in bold black type, and my heart quailed when I saw it. How did anyone know if the voices would come? I was not able to guarantee then, any more than I can guarantee today, that phenomena will occur. So why on earth, I wondered, had I allowed the enthusiasm of my sponsors to talk me into appearing in a public hall in front of hundreds of people who had paid to hear them? I did not know then, as do not I know now, what the most favorable conditions are for the voices to manifest, but I began strongly to suspect that a public hall filled with hundreds of people, all with varying motives, different ways of thinking and in or out of harmony with each other, was likely to be less than ideal. I spent days plunged in the deepest gloom, anticipating failure and public humiliation. It was only Edith's gentle reminders that those who helped me from the other side of life have never failed me which kept me on a sufficiently even keel to board the Green Lion coach with her for the journey to London on the big day. All the way there I envied all the other passengers because they were not Leslie Flint on his way to London about to make a fool of himself in public. Once I was seated on the platform of the Victoria Hall, surrounded by the familiar faces of Noah and his friends, I felt somewhat more relaxed, though the people packing the auditorium looked just like one big menacing blur. I listened to various speeches without really hearing a word of any of them. Then Noah advanced to the edge of the platform and told the menacing blur that an experiment was about to take place with a new young voice medium, Leslie Flint. My hour had come. Noah asked for all the lights in the hall to be put out, with the sole exception of the exit signs, which must remain on to conform with public safety regulations. When this was done, I was dismayed to see the hall was so full of light, not only from the exit signs, but light was coming in from all directions and this was going to make any demonstration of my mediumship even more difficult than I had imagined. With all the optimism of Daniel entering the lion's den, I sat in the chair provided for me on the platform and I waited. After a few moments, those on the platform heard a voice speak very faintly, much too faintly for anyone in the audience to hear it. Someone on the platform suggested he could shield me from the light with his coat, so he removed it and held it up in front of me.